gives me a great deal of pleasure to introduce Charlene Epp. You all have her biography in front of you, so I won't bother to tell you anything that you can't read for yourself. Charlene will be bringing our devotional, and then following a song will lead us in the program today. And so it's my pleasure to introduce my friend, Charlene.
It's good to be here this afternoon.
Could you please talk into the microphone?
Is that better? All right. No, I think I'm good. Thank you. A devotional for a beating of a historical society. Our faith is cradled and carried in the context of story. A story of people throughout history striving to live faith-filled lives in loving relationship with their God, with one another, with all of that God created and called good. Without those spiritual ancestors and the sacred texts that hold their stories, our own faith journey would be devoid of depth, of the assurance of things for which to hope, of the conviction to believe in that which is not seen. In turn, our own effort at living in faith-filled relationship with God and one another becomes raw material for shaping and transforming the faith of those around us and the next generations. The writer of the book of Hebrews speaks eloquently and very specifically of some of the impact of the faith of some of our spiritual ancestors, Abraham and Sarah, their Hebrew faith community, and their heirs. Found in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, verses 8 through 16. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to set out for a place that he was to receive as an inheritance. And he set out not knowing where he was going. By faith, he stayed for a time in the land he had been promised, as in a foreign land, living in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked forward to the city that had foundations, whose architect and builder is God. By faith, he received power of procreation, even though he was too old, and Sarah herself was barren, because he considered him faithful who had promised. Therefore, from one person, and this one as good as dead, descendants were born, as many as the stars of heaven and as the innumerable grains of sand by the seashore. All of these died in faith without having received the promises, but from a distance they saw and greeted them. They confessed that they were strangers and foreigners on the earth, for the people who speak in this way make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of the land that they had left behind, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God. Indeed, he has prepared a city for them. We too are heirs of the promise that God is our guide in our faith pilgrimage. It is and can be a journey riddled with adventure, risks, and uncertain routes. The writer of the Hebrews gives testimony to a God who unashamedly honors our faith-filled intentions. When acting and living in faith and trust that our journey seeking a homeland whose architect and builder is God we are met by God's response of preparing a place of communal completeness, resourced with richness, surpassing any human material comprehension or experience. This is the inherited spiritual legacy of our ancestors. It is the spiritual responsibility of us, and it is the spiritual possibility for our spiritual heirs. May we be bearers of faith that is transformative in the lives of those around us and amongst us. Amen.
All of you should have a program, and the back of your program should have words to the poem, actually, to the song, Through the Desert Goes Our Journey, which is the title for our presentation this morning, or this afternoon. And my understanding is this was a song that was sung many times as these folks journeyed across the desert themselves. So again, if you would stand, the tune is a familiar one, Heart with Loving Heart United, and we'll sing the words on the page.
Through the desert goes our journey to the Thank you.
Is this better? Okay. First of all, I want to thank you for the invitation to come this afternoon to tell a story from the Mennonite history that has impacted and continues to impact many people, both Mennonite and non-Mennonite. And as the perspectives and understandings of this story are reformed, so are the possibilities of the ongoing transformation of us as individuals and amongst us as a people of faith. Attending to history, as you well know, can be a means of transforming our perspectives and responses to current relationships and situations. And this is the backdrop with which I am offering what you are about to hear and see. Our ancestral story as Mennonite has chapters in it that some of us may wish were not a part of the history books. Some find these chapters disturbing. Some treat these chapters as something from the past that has no relevance for today. Some believe these chapters are heretical or embarrassing failures. There are some who choose to engage with the content of these chapters in an effort to understand, to come to terms with what it is that took place. The brief piece, and it is a brief piece, of Mennonite history we are engaging with this afternoon is one such chapter. The segment of Mennonite history, specifically that which led up to and during and post what became known as the Great Trek, has largely been avoided, criticized, and misunderstood for the 130 plus years since the first wagon train left the Trakt colony in Russia for Uzbekistan. When told of or written about for most of these 130 years, this piece of history tended to place sole responsibility for the migration to Central Asia on the shoulders of Klaus Hepp Jr., my great-great-grandfather, and in less than a flattering manner. With the blame for the hardships endured by those who migrated to Central Asia, and the sharp criticism of Klaus's increasingly fanatical theology, came a struggle on the part of the Mennonite community with what to do with those who were a part of this migration as well as their descendants. Beginning, though, in the 1960s, there was a very slow and preciously fledgling process that began to take root, the revisitation of this story of the Great Trek. Some individuals retraced parts of the original migration routes. Others began to write with precious little information with which to work. Controversies arose amongst historians over methods and sources of information that were used for these ventures. This seemed to feed and represent a quest on the part of some who found reason to question the story as it had been told, at least up to this point. Somehow there was an unconscious awareness that there were pieces missing to the understanding of what had taken place prior to, during, and after that journey. It is just such a quest that about 25 participants, tour participants, pursued in late May and early June of 2007. And it was the first organized group, Mennonite group tour, to retrace the history of the Great Trek beyond the Ukraine. Our reasons for embarking on that journey were just as diverse as those of the original participants of the Great Trek. Tour participants came armed with ancestors' journals and documents that had never before been shared publicly and to that point had been held secretly amongst family members. A treasure chest of information and new understanding was opened, shared, and enriched by the encounters we had throughout this trip. And we'll take a brief look at what we were pursuing in our 2000 pilgrimage that started in Kiev, Uzbekistan, where we landed. In his book, Pilgrims on the Silk Road, Walter Ratliff bears witness to a paralleled and merging story, history, of Christian-Muslim relations in relating the story of the Mennonite migration to Central Asia. Through the course of the century plus that Mennonites and Muslims encountered a cycle of conflict and cooperation in their relationships with one another. The first such encounter was recorded began with when the Mennonites settled in Novorossiya, which was New Russia, in the Molochna colony. Just a few decades later, the tables were turned when the Mennonites settled in the Muslim area of Uzbekistan. It was Catherine the Great who gave Mennonites land that a Turkish Muslim tribe had roamed in their nomadic lifestyle since about 1630. Catherine's invitation came with the Manifesto of 1763 and was extended to farmers throughout Europe, many of whom had grown wheat and most of whom had financially prospered as farmers. In March of 1788, a binding legal agreement with the Russian government guaranteed the Mennonites autonomy and freedom of conscience for as long as they lived in the empire, stating they could live as a separate community, they could have their own educational system, and they could be exempt from conscription to the military service. Once this agreement was in place, the first Mennonite colony was settled in Tertitsa in 1789. These Prussian Mennonites brought with them wealth and consequently influence with the local Russian authorities, sometimes at the expense of the poorer ones who lived within the Mennonite settlements. Among the poorest in the settlements were the local Russians, primarily of the Orthodox religious tradition, and a very small remaining element of the nomadic Nogales, the Muslim group. The Mennonites soon became the managers of the local Russian workers, and the Nogali people, who contended with the ever-changing demands and whims of the Russian authorities, eventually participated in a mass exodus in 1860, which left less than 100 of their tribe living in and amongst the Mennonites in the colony. At this point, the Mennonites found themselves negotiating business deals with the Nogales, who had not so long ago caused hardship and harm, including death, to members of the Mennonite colony, where these Nogali now also resided side by side as neighbors. Klaus Epp Sr. was a leader and part of a later group of Mennonites that settled along the Volga River in Samara in the Tracht colony of Russia in 1853. He was a serious man with a mind for civil and economic matters. As had become common among Mennonites throughout Europe, Mennonite community leaders entered into agreements with local governments to secure the community's ability to live by their Anabaptist core beliefs. And in turn, these Mennonites became model farmers in their host nations. In these agreements, often the hosting nations banned the Mennonites from proselytizing beyond their own community. Klaus Epp Sr.'s son, Klaus Epp Jr., was 15 when the Mennonites migrated from the Vistula Delta area of Prussia to the Trakt colony in Russia. The manner in which he observed relationships between his father and local Russian authorities, as well as the dynamics of relationships amongst the Mennonites within the colony and others who were a part of the settlement community, shaped him in significant ways. From the very beginning, as the Mennonites resettled in areas of Russia, there were disputes among the members within the colonies and between the leaders of the various groups. These disputes were fueled by vies for leadership positions, as well as opposing positions on political and theological matters. Mennonites were influenced both externally and internally in regard to many matters. Those having some significant influence included German Pietism, which found easy traction amongst this faith group that was feeling a need for revitalization. By 1860, new leadership developed under movements desiring enforcement of more rigorous spiritual disciplines. The combination of the internal conflicts and the external influences resulted in partings and schisms, where new groups under new leadership developed. One such group was the Mennonite Brethren, who broke from the Mother Church and worshipped in an abandoned mosque of the Nogales on Pentecost Sunday of the same year, in 1860. Connected to the Pietist movement were the ongoing millennial movements that crossed religious faith groups, impacting faith communities around the globe over a period that spanned a couple of centuries. Of significant influence among the Mennonites was the writing of Johann Heinrich Jungstilling. His novel, Das Heimweh, meaning the homesickness, became raw material along with the biblical texts of Daniel and Revelation for writings and discussions around the end times. Crunching the numbers from these written materials is what Klaus Epp Jr. used to determine the date and location of Jesus' second coming. As national boundaries and leaders changed, so did the honoring of the agreements that had protected the Mennonites' ability to live as the city of God, a community pure unto its faith, therefore privileged to be exempt from enduring the tribulation. Leaders in the Russian Mennonite settlements began exploring how and where God was opening a door for them to enter into yet another, hopefully, secure setting where they could live out their faith beliefs. More parting occurred due to the theological differences, causing some to immigrate west to North America and others to identify a migration east. Again, due to the influence of material including Jungstilling's novel, for those heading east, it was determined that the time was actually running short to get to the designated location to be protected during the tribulation as what they came to call themselves as the bride community. They were to be privileged to be spared from the tribulation, but be able to witness it. This movement to the east actually fit with a long Mennonite history of an eastward movement. The Dutch that moved to Germany, from Germany to Prussia, from Prussia to Turkestan. Some Swiss Mennonites immigrated to North America as early as 1683, while many others went east into an area in the region of Volhynia, Poland, in order to be able to move to what was Turkestan. A secret delegation was given to the mission to address the unresolved issues for the Mennonites, the Russian Mennonites, to be able to settle there. Those in the delegation were Peter Weeb from Molechna colony and Jacob Ham from the Tracht settlement. These two, along with Abram Peters, Martin Clausen, Cornelius Wall, and Klaus Hepp Jr., spent many hours disputing politics and theology, often seeking positions of primary leadership within the groups. All shared the common theological millennialism position of the imminent return of Christ. Within months of the designated departure date for the first wagon train from the Russian colonies, agreements were finally secured for a place of refuge in Central Asia. On the first wagon train, a young man, Herman Jansen, was able to pick up the languages very quickly of the people that they met along the way and became a valued asset in negotiating and translating on behalf of the Mennonites. He later acquired a key role in the Turkish government, first as a court interpreter, then as an interior ministry official for the Russian Turkestan. After that, he became a missionary in what is now known as Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and Kyrgyzstan. Along the trek, many died of disease. The wagon trains were attacked and robbed. Women were abused and raped. Simultaneously, continued theological disputes, often over concerns around Klaus's escalating extreme positions, caused trekkers to part company, some returning to Germany, many immigrating west. When the remaining members of the first three wagons met in Tashkent, more disputes arose, and another significant segment of the group parted company with the migration. The majority of these immigrants were close followers of Abram Peters, who actually died during that period in Tashkent. This group, including Cornelius Wall, settled in an area called Aliata, what is now Kazakhstan. In a short period of time, Martin Clausen also died, leading Klaus Epp Jr., the primary leader of the remaining members of the Bride community, but not yet with them because he was on the last train, wagon train. As the community resumed travel, the Great Comet of 1882 guided their way through the Kizilkum Desert. They traveled by night because of the searing heat during the day. For this part of the trip, all of their vehicles and their were disassembled, and their possessions, along with the disassembled vehicles, were placed on camels and trekked across the desert. There were hundreds of camels involved in that. And then the vehicles were reassembled once they reached the western edge of the desert, and actually the eastern edge of the desert, and the group continued their journey. This group, now the three wagon trains, the remaining of that group, settled near Sarabulak for about 8 months. During this time, they shared worship in a space in Kai Ata, or what was called the Blue Grandfather Mosque. They meeting on Sundays, and the Muslims on Fridays. Dissension in this traveling community was reaching yet another new height. A.K. Penner stepped forward on their very first meeting that first Sunday in the mosque, refuting Klaus Epp's teaching. Remember that Klaus and the final wagon train had not yet caught up with this group of people. Many in that audience were persuaded by Penner's preaching. However, the faithful followers of Klaus Epp asked Penner to leave the congregation. At this point, the group is now split into three groups, but they continued to live together through what was a very bitter winter around Sarah Bullock. As you might expect, promises weren't kept for the location of the Mennonite settlement, and the community headed further into an area called Lausanne. Here, the Yomud tribesmen took advantage of the Mennonites' non-resistance, becoming increasingly violent, finally murdering a young groom on his wedding night. The Khan of Hiva took pity on this traveling company. The Khan's general had gone to assess the Mennonite situation in Lausanne, returning to the Khan with a finely crafted small wooden chest made by the Mennonites. And the craftsmanship of this small wooden box so impressed the Khan that he offered the Mennonites the use of his walled 13-acre garden on his country estate outside of Hiva. It was in this walled garden that the Mennonites developed what became a successful community for more than 50 years. The Muslims in that area observed the Mennonites whitewashing their church, which sat in the middle of their community, and named the settlement Ak Machet, meaning white mosque. The village that later developed next to the walled garden adopted the same name, honoring those who were good neighbors, farmers, craftsmen, and held to a nonviolent position. This is my brother and I inside that walled garden in what we believe was probably the location of Klaus and Elizabeth Epp's home. My great-great-grandfather and great-great-grandmother. Within the community, dissension mounted as Klaus's theological teachings became increasingly radical. Additionally, his leadership style assumed even stricter versions of authoritarianism than that of even his own father. His career as a spiritual leader reached a turning point when the day he predicted for Christ's return ended with another failed prophecy. Klaus went on to set another date, after which there was a final significant parting, including with his own son, who along with his children, his family, and three other families left for America. The decreased confidence in F. Jr. as a trusted leader only seemed to increase the nature of his theological claims. On Pentecost Sunday, 1894, F. Jr. announced he was to be respected as sitting at the left hand of the Father, just as Jesus sits on the right hand. Klaus Jr. and his wife Elizabeth were excommunicated for the last 10 years of their lives, remaining housed in the center of the Ak Machet Mennonite settlement. They died within 6 days of one another in January of 1913. Ak Machet came to thrive and develop trusted relationships with its Muslim neighbors. The school in the village houses two wooden desks built by the Mennonites, along with irons that the Mennonites used for clothing, ironing their clothes, and were left behind in their very abrupt haste in 1935 when they left the settlement. The villagers today proudly speak of having finely crafted wooden doors and windows in their houses that were made by the Mennonites. They speak of an annual spring pre-planting ritual of prayers held at where the Mennonite cemetery used to be, honoring the agricultural skills and contributions the Mennonites brought to their community. Oblivious to them is any reference to a fanatical leader. Unknown to them was the dissension that existed within the Mennonite community itself and the disputes that happened. Throughout this story are examples when this faith community's beliefs were pressed for a response. Peppered throughout the story are decisive choices to retain a nonviolent response, something that continues to hold the attention of the current residents of that Akhmetchet community, as well as scholars who have dedicated their careers to piecing together the history of the people of Uzbekistan and with whom the story of the Mennonites holds a prominent place in telling the history of Uzbekistan. Our pilgrimage in 2007 rendered a perspective of the Great Trek that neither discounts the impact of the end times theology, nor does it allow for any individual or their errant theology to retain center stage for what has become a treasured contribution to our story of faith. The story that you have heard this afternoon remains told by a particular Mennonite with a particular Mennonite perspective. Other Mennonites would tell the story from the perspective of having stayed in Central Asia or returning to Germany from Central Asia or immigrating from Central Asia through China to the East. All these stories would give more fullness to the legacy of this great Trek immigration and the impact of it on the heirs of its story. Additionally, there is a story to be told from the perspective of the Muslims who encountered the Mennonites near the Volga, or the perspective of the Muslims who lived and worked with the Mennonites near Hiva, Uzbekistan. These two are stories that shed more light on the faith journey and witness of the Mennonites, as well as how the Mennonites were impacted by and learned from their relationships with the Muslims. To do justice to this story of migration, to bear witness to the legacy of the faith it holds, to offer hope and possibilities of our faith to our spiritual heirs, it is invaluable to hear as many possible perspectives of this story as possible. Honoring the impact of the experience from all the angles gives us a richer heritage and a stronger point for continued faith. This requires openness. Throughout the written documents, books, or personal journals of those who embarked on this adventure is a recurring reference to Revelation chapter 3, verses 7 and 8. And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, These are the words of the Holy One, the True One, who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, who shuts and no one will open. I know your works. Look, I have set before you an open door which no one is able to shut. I know that you have but little power, and yet you have kept my word and have not denied my name. Held precious by many in that original group of travelers on the great trek was the promise of God's provision of a safe passage for the little flock who remained faithful, who did not deny the name of God. They saw in the midst of their treacherous trek God opening doors for them to find a place of refuge. In 2007, after years of shame and silence, a door, actually many doors, were opened in Uzbekistan when once again Mennonites and Muslims encountered one another with a shared history. Held precious by many who retraced the trek in 2007 and on the subsequent tours in 2008 and 2009 is a faith that the door that was opened will not be shut. The open door offers the ability to see more clearly the breadth and depth of faithfulness of our ancestors. It gives a view of the powerful impact of having right and vibrant relationships with our neighbors, regardless of how different our faith may be. Through our continued journey of faith, even when blind and stumbling, holding fast to naming God as our sovereign ruler, and living in faithful obedience to the life and words of Christ, we too can be secure in the promise that our works are known. It just may be that exactly this journey is the homeland we seek.
Yeah. we found out about our ancestors is if in such a different light, and that is very beautiful. indicate that this would be a part of my deeper understanding. There's no state within an individual. It moves out. As the kingdom happens here, it moves out.
I think it's very exciting to be watching now and seeing progress as we talk about this history of ours in a new way, realizing that, for instance, this great trek would have probably happened with or without Class F Junior. And their belief that there would be a second coming in Central Asia was not the only reason that they went to Central Asia, of course. And the fact that they lived so peaceably with the Muslims there is quite a lesson for us all.
I think today we're just at the beginning of this remembering process. I would think over the next 5, 10, 15 years, we'll hear a lot more about Akhmashet, and a lot more Mennonites will be visiting there, and we will celebrate an episode in Muslim-Christian relationships as well as successful development of successful Christian communities.
Thank you, Charlene. Now it's your time to participate. Do you have questions for Charlene? And I'll bring you a microphone so everybody can hear well. We're also recording this, so that will help as well.
I was wondering on this one of these handouts that said that two-thirds of the people died. There was only one-third remained. Was that... Can you explain that? Is that because they left? Some of them died from sickness or from being murdered?
If it says two-thirds died, that's not accurate, which would be true to how this story gets told. It has to be corrected many times. There were approximately 600 who left the Russian colonies. About a third... just under a third landed in Akhmashet. Along the way, many died. The statistics get close to a third of that original 600, not quite, but many parted ways, immigrating elsewhere. So I think at one point, Akhmashet had about 150 people. It gradually built up again in the years that followed the actual settlement. Most of the people left, not died along the way.
In that classroom, there were girls with long blonde hair. Does that mean that there are still remnants of the Russian Mennonite people with blonde hair in that area?
That was a picture that would have been when the Mennonites were still settled there. So that represents that. However, towards the end of the slideshow, there was a picture of a journalist, and I think it says underneath that it was Penner. His mom was a Penner. She actually went back to Germany and then ended up coming back to, was it Kazakhstan? I can't remember. It was actually Uzbekistan that she came back to, because going back to Germany at that time, they were no better off in Germany. So she ended up coming back to Uzbekistan. So he was raised in Uzbekistan. Obviously, you can tell the color of skin. His father was Muslim. She was Mennonite. So there are remnants.
How many miles was the trek, did you say?
Most of the material says about 2,000 miles. 3,000 kilometers.
The environment looked really harsh with sand blowing, and were the camels that we were seeing, was that the trek that was reenacted? Was there a reenactment?
No, that was an actual movie clip that Walter got a hold of, but would have represented what it was like, yeah.
Well, these stories reminded me of a story from my own that I heard from a Mennonite refugee, probably in 48 or 49, when I was working at a refugee camp in northwest Germany. And she talked about the terrible sadness she had when she lost a child. A child had died, and she had to bury that child and continue on her trek. And so she could not go back to that grave. The loss seemed like a double whammy to her. And I had to think, again, in your story, how true that must have been of many of those people who would have lost family members but had to bury them along the way.
Just to that point, that a lot of the journal entries that we read along the way, it was amazing. There was no emotion. Buried my child, buried two children. It was just a matter of fact. That was part of what happened along the way, right?
There have been several books that have been published on this. Have the journals of all of these people ever been collectively transcribed and published in an unnarrated format at all?
Only a few of the journals have. We have some materials up here on the piano. Herman Jansen's was, and I think he was about 14, he was a teenager on the trek itself. There's Elizabeth Unruh's, which I think her family has published in a limited version, but there's a lot of journals, including some of the material that was in my family, that we got the English translation of the letters, but we didn't get the original letters. Some of that material is not published. There's a lot that still is hidden. It's gradually coming out, but having it published while people are still alive who have had to deal with some of the ramifications has been an ongoing question. What is the timing and how do we do this? There's much in the Bethel archives, the library archives.
A problem with women who had remarried, thinking they'd never see their husbands again, and then many decades later, the husband appears. So there's a lot of trauma and tragedy in the whole story.
How did this affect you as a child growing up, and what did your parents tell you about this story?
Was not discussed in my family home. My grandfather, who would have been the son of the leader of the trek, my grandfather Ben left his home community of Beatrice, Nebraska, because that was a pretty painful place to live. That is not the only community where it was very difficult to live. But as a result, I believe a lot of what he was doing was getting away and getting away from the story. So it didn't even come up as a topic until the 70s in our home, when one of my older sisters was a student at Bethel, a history major, and began working on a book that became very controversial, Fred Belk's book that is on the table here, and he was in the video itself. She worked along with James Yonke, who was one of the leaders of our tour group, a historian. And that is the point where there started to be some conversation in our family, talking about it. But the stories that we had were not accurate. The stories that came to us were just not true. And repeatedly, the story has had to be revised as more information has come out as to what actually happened. So my family, I think I was protected because my grandfather chose to get away. Those descendants who lived in Beatrice, Nebraska was not the only town, but there are a number of communities where the descendants or those who had been on the trek moved into experienced a much more painful childhood, even of this generation, including a couple of people on our tour group who literally went like to have coffee with someone the week before they were heading on the trip and reluctantly would inform the group that they were going on this tour. And the response to them was, why would you want to go on that trip? Why would you want to bring up that story? Why would you want to bring back the crazy ups and the great trek? That's, you know, the whole message being very shameful. That's 2007. So it's still a very difficult story to be with.
So Charlene, what was the impetus for doing the tour? I mean, for creating the tour and the process of organizing the tour?
I think that's a couple fold. One, Walter Ratliff, who did the documentary and who wrote the book, is a descendant of one of the original trekkers, and he has done a fair amount of work with Christian-Muslim relationships, and this story has been a story of intrigue to him for years. And in his making of connections, he got connected with James Yonke, who also has held a very somewhat conflicted relationship with the story, and that germinated the idea amongst them and in connection with others, maybe it's time for us to go and see it. I feel very fortunate that we hosted Jim the year before the trek and found out that he was going to do it and said, you let us know. I'm going.
Well, you said that a number of the folks on the tour were descendants. Were these people sought out and invited personally, or it was just advertised and because they were descendants, they jumped the opportunity to do it?
There was some advertising done. I don't know if there was individual invitations. I think people were wanting to find out more, and when this became known, the word spread. They didn't want the tour group to be 25 people. That is a large group for a tour. It can be a little bit hard to manage, but they couldn't say no either when many people came forward. People just really wanted to have this experience.
Is it this year or next year that John Sharp is leading a tour to Uzbekistan also? I think with Tour Imagination.
That could be. I hadn't heard of that. That would be great because there were the two tours that happened the 2 years following us, and then Uzbekistan sort of closed, tightened its fist a little bit, making it difficult to do further tours. So that would be great news to know that they were trying to make a tour group go back again. I hadn't heard that. The bowl that was given to the imam came from Oregon. It's a myrtle bowl. Before we went on the trip, our tour guides encouraged us to bring along small items that we could give as gifts when we were hosted and so forth, not knowing what and when those were going to be used. And literally on the tour was when that mosque was discovered. It was not known where its whereabouts beforehand. When we drove into the village of Sarabulak, our guide Marina just had the bus driver stop every once in a while and just started asking people in the village, "Do you know anything about a mosque where Mennonites worshipped?" Finally, this man said, "Oh, I know something about that." And he gets on the bus, directs us to the mosque. And that is the first that anybody knew exactly where the mosque was and actually saw it, other than the one picture, the still picture that was on the video screen of it. That is the only evidence of the mosque that was shared in worship by those two groups. So the myrtle bowl, when it became apparent that this was going to happen, because the Mennonites were known for their wood craftsmanship, it just seemed like an appropriate gift. And so it was a piece of Oregon taken to Uzbekistan.
One more question. Okay. Thank you, Charlene. Charlene will hang around. Charlene and Duncan both will hang around a little while afterwards, so give you a chance to look at the materials they've brought or ask other questions you might have. Let's stand for our closing prayer. Eternal God, we give you thanks for the founders of your church, for those whom you called and formed in the image of your Son, for those who suffered and died for their faith. We give you thanks for the reformers of your church, for their rediscovery of truth, for their eagerness to live simply, for their faithful study of your word, for their endeavor to serve their neighbors. God of our forebears, give us the courage and wisdom of the saints who have gone before us. Form us in the image of your Son. Renew your Holy Spirit's work in our generation. May we live and serve under the rule of Jesus Christ until your reign comes. Amen. Go in peace.